you.
Well, good evening. How are you this evening? I want to thank you and thank the group here for the invitation to come and share at North Dakota State this weekend. Tonight's first presentation is entitled Repenting of Religion. And there's a little bit of prolegomena here that I want to share with you. In that title, I want to make it clear I'm not referring to the Hindu religion. I'm not talking to the religion of Islam. I am not speaking of any other type of religion except for the tradition simply that I was raised in. And that is specifically the Christian religion, for reasons that I hope will become clear as we progress. I also want to say that as we look at the Jesus story this weekend, I think the Jesus story, the story narrative, has lessons to be discovered still by both Christian and non-Christian alike. I am not a practitioner of historical criticism. I subscribe to what is labeled today as rhetorical criticism. And what that simply means is that when we look at the Jesus story, we endeavor to try and discern what the story truth is of the story rather than the historical or the historicity, the historical credibility of the story. I don't mean to imply that I think that the Jesus story is nothing more than a fairy tale. But just as we come to fairy tales, we don't endeavor to first prove that Cinderella really happened in human history before we learn the lessons of such a story. And I think much is lost in our culture today when we try and prove the historical reliability of the Jesus story before we allow it to speak into our lives and to speak to us, especially in the area of ethics, before we try to glean from its story truth. So we're going to be looking at the story truth this weekend rather than the historical truth. And once again, I think that when we do that, the story of Jesus today has yet, there's a lot there to be discovered, even by American Christianity, just as much as non-Christians may discover truths in that story. I want to also talk about my use of pronouns. I do not believe that God is, when we talk about a God, I do not believe that God is neither male nor female. That's my belief. We are speaking within the Jesus story, and I think it's imperative that we stay within the boundaries of that story if we're going to discover what that story is. The Jesus story teaches that there is a God, at least that's its message, and that it speaks of that God as being personal, as being relational, as being a father. And so while I would endeavor to try to use gender-neutral pronouns for God this weekend, the fact is the only gender-neutral pronoun we have in the English language is, does anyone know? It. That's right. And the Jesus story tells us that the God that Jesus spoke about in the story, this Jesus, was more than an it. It was his father. And so I want to use a personal pronoun, but I'm stuck with either a he or a she, and I don't think either one accurately represents my own belief system. So we're just going to stay within the Jesus story itself. We'll be using male pronouns, but ladies, please just know we're doing that because of the limitation of the English language and because we're trying to discover. I think if those who are fans of the Jesus story already can really capture what the Jesus story is saying, it could rock their world, especially them. And so I want to try and stay within the context of that as much as possible. So I hope that you'll forgive me on the limitations that are there. And the last thing I want to say is I want to make you a solemn promise, and that is that at no point in this weekend will I ever invite any of you present to embrace or to join American evangelical Christianity. We are simply looking at the Jesus story as we have it today. Reliable or not, what is this story telling us in its form that we possess? Mahatma Gandhi, how many here are a fan of Mahatma Gandhi? Mahatma Gandhi is one of my heroes. And one of my favorite statements that Gandhi made was he said, "I like your Christ, I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." Now, what was the context of this statement? The only form of Christianity that Gandhi had encountered was British colonial Christianity. How many recognize that colonial Christianity is a far cry from the Jesus story narrative? How many would agree with that? Matter of fact, when Gandhi was asked to what did he attribute his success in driving out Britain from India, he not only mentioned his own Hindu scriptures, but he claimed that for the past decade he had meditated on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, he said, for 2 hours every day. Now, Gandhi remained a Hindu his entire life, but he also claimed to be a follower of Jesus, at least the Jesus he found in this story. He also went so far as when Lord Irwin asked him what he thought would solve the problems between the British Empire and India, the story says that Gandhi reached over on the desk, picked up a Bible, opened it up to Matthew 5, and said to Lord Irwin, "When your country and my country can come to terms with what this Jesus taught in this sermon," referring to the Sermon on the Mount, he said, "we will not only have solved the problems between our two countries, we will have solved the problems of the world." Now, I'm not here to debate whether that's true or not. The question I want to ask is, what was it that Gandhi was seeing in the Jesus story that Christians today are still missing? I think it's a shame that a Baptist minister in the South, now I can say that because I'm from the South, a Baptist minister in the Bible Belt, maybe you don't realize what that signifies. A Baptist minister in the Bible Belt had to go and sit at the feet of a little brown Hindu in India to discover what his Jesus was really all about ethically. Maybe not religiously, but ethically. And when King came back from that encounter, King was armed with an ethic that would bring radical revolution in the United States during his era. Now, once again, I want to go on record as just telling all of you, I am a white American male in my mid-30s, actually late 30s now. I am what American society is built for. I am the one who is favored by American society. And so I am not as invested in the history surrounding Martin Luther King and the change of the social changes that he made as others might be. But what I respect about King the most is not only the changes he made within American society, but the methods that he used to bring about those changes. King claimed to have gotten his methods from the same place that Gandhi had gotten those methods, and that was Christ's ethical teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. And so this weekend, what I would like to do is to take a look at those teachings as they are within the story that we have, and to just simply ask, do these teachings, not the ethics of the Christian religion, do the ethics of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, do they hold any relevance to the problems that human society is facing today, and do they offer us any hope? That's the direction we're going to be moving in. Now, to embark on that, I kind of want to sneak up on the Jesus story this evening. We're going to be looking at some why the ethics, I think, are credible in the latter half tonight. We're going to be talking about what those ethics actually were tomorrow night. But before we get there in this first half, I kind of want to sneak up on it and see if we can't discover a little bit of something of the Jesus story. We're going to begin in Luke chapter 14. Verse 7 through 15. Now, Jesus had been invited. The context here is that Jesus had been invited over to the Pharisees' house for a lunch on their Jewish Sabbath afternoon, after synagogue. And the Pharisees, if we're to understand the historical context, the Jesus story is in a, and hopefully this will make sense to you, the Jesus story is told in a strictly Jewish context, first century Jewish context. It is not told in the context of a 16th century Protestant Reformation. It's told in the context of Judaism. And within the Jewish culture of Jesus' day, the Pharisees were much like the religious right that we find here in America. They were going to take Jerusalem back for God. They used that kind of rhetoric. They were known as the moral police of Jewish society. Does any of that sound familiar to anyone this evening? Do we have people like that? It's okay to smile. Do we have religious folks like that in American society today? Yes, absolutely. This was the religious political party of Jesus' day. They were the Pharisees. So he's invited over to their house for lunch. And it says, when he noticed how the guest picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then humiliated, you'll have to take the least important place. But when you're invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. What we know from the cultural context that we have available to us today at this time is that Jesus is here quoting a document that we have from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's called the Rule of the Messiah, or in some examples, it's referred to as the Rule of the Congregation. And the story of this document, it was a document that was highly valued by the Pharisees, by the political party of that day. What this document stated was that when Messiah would come, he would restore Israel to its national status. And in doing so, this Messiah would be the pinnacle. He would lead out in a violent, militaristic revolution against the Gentiles. All of Israel's enemies, which in their day they would have interpreted that as the Romans, would have been mercilessly slaughtered by this Messiah and his army, his soldiers, his battle chariots. And then after all of Israel's enemies have been annihilated, then he would hold a great banquet. And in this banquet, your morality would determine in what order you were seated at that banquet. Those who were very righteous, they would be sitting closest to the Messiah, while those who were less righteous or maybe didn't play as significant a role in this revolution, this militaristic, violent revolution, they would have a much lower place of honor at the table. And not only did the document say that their seating arrangement would be based on morality, they said their seating arrangement would also be based on not just how religiously pure they were, but there were even physical anatomical limitations. The poor, the blind, the lame, if there was anything physically wrong with you, you would not only have a lower position, you wouldn't even get invited to this banquet. You would be excluded from this, which is why Jesus says next, watch what he does. Then Jesus said to the host, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back so that you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the, what does it say? The poor. And it said, invite the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Now, this was a direct contradiction to the document, the Rule of the Messiah. Their understanding, their belief, this political party, was that these people wouldn't even be invited. You're telling us, what Jesus is saying is, no, when you hold a banquet, invite these guys, and not only invite them, but if you add this to the previous statement, give them which position at the table? Talk to me now tonight. I'm from the South, so you can't talk back. Which position would you give them at the table? The highest, if you couple this together, nothing would have been more offensive to his host. Nothing would have been more offensive to these Pharisees. You see, in this culture, this was a culture based on a misinterpretation of Deuteronomy 28, which simply said, if you obeyed, God will bless you. If you disobey, God will curse you. So if you're poor, you're blind, you're lame, you're crippled, if you're impoverished, we look at people who are sick today, and I hope we feel some type of compassion, and we look at them as being less fortunate. If you agree with that, say yes. In their day, they didn't look at this social strata as less fortunate. If they were living that kind of a life, they must have sinned. If you obey, God will bless you. If you're not being blessed, you must have sinned somewhere. And therefore, you're not less fortunate. You're a sinner, and you're getting what you deserve. They looked at this crowd as being morally inferior to them. If you were poor or blind or crippled, they felt morally superior to you. They knew they were righteous because they're not suffering any of that. When Jesus tells them to invite those who are what we read as less fortunate, he's saying invite those that you feel morally superior to, that you think are sinners. You have to get the cultural context. This would be the equivalent of asking the Westboro Baptist Church to hold a Christmas dinner next month for the LGBT community. Would they struggle with that? Just a bit. This is the same thing Jesus is doing here, and this is why the man responds, the Pharisee responds. It says, when one of those at the table heard him say this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed are those who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Now, when he says that, he's not quoting some Christian ideal, an eschatological understanding. This Pharisee is quoting the rule of the Messiah, saying, you're trying to take that document and turn it on its head. Blessed are those who will eat at that feast. What they're doing is they're rejecting Jesus' ethics for the ethics revealed in that legend of what the Messiah would do, that prophecy of what the Messiah would do. So then Jesus, in his usual manner, all of that is prolegomena, all of that is context to understand what he does next. Jesus replies, a certain man, it's as if he says, you want to talk about that banquet? Let's talk about that for a moment. A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. The way banquets worked back then was you sent out invitations. It was kind of like we use the RSVP today. And depending upon how many said they would be there, depended upon what you had for dinner. If two people said they were going to come to your banquet, then you would prepare quail. If 10 people said they would come to your banquet, then you would prepare chicken. If 50 people said they would come to your banquet, you would prepare lamb. If 200 people said they were going to come to your banquet, you would slay the fatted calf. Are we all on the same page so far? So he sends out these invitations. He gets these commitments to come to the banquet. Preparations are made for this huge, opulent banquet. And then he sends out the announcement, come, everything is now ready. And then they all alike begin to make, what does it say? Excuses. One says, I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me. I want you to think about everything you know about the Middle East tonight. Do you really think they're going to buy a piece of property without knowing whether there's water or oil on that property first? When do you usually do due diligence on a piece of property that you're buying? Before or after you purchase it? Yeah, so there's something shady about this. The next one says, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. When do you test drive a car, before or after you buy it? The next one he says, still another said, I just got married, so I can't come. I understand that one fully. That one makes sense to me. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became what emotion? Angry, and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and the alleys and the town and bring in the, here they are again, bring in the who? The poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Remember, to them, they would have heard sinners. They would have heard morally inferior. Then the master told his servant, go out. Oh, then came back and said, there's still more room. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and the country lanes and urge them to come in so that my house may be, what does he say? Full. Some would say here that this host is lowering the standard. I'm submitting to you that the host in this story is actually obliterating the standard and saying, anyone, olly olly and free, anybody who's hungry, I just want my house full. There is no precondition. And then they go out in the country lanes. They go in and gather the itinerant peasant farmers that are indentured to the Roman Empire. As I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. What's the story truth in this story that this Jesus is telling them? That's right. In other words, those who were initially invited won't even get a taste of it. You see, the story actually starts off with Jesus healing a man at this luncheon. You'll notice we pick it up in verse 7, but 1 through 7 tells the story of how Jesus healed a man on their Sabbath. It says they all stood silent, waiting to see what Jesus would do. Jesus says, is it lawful to do good or evil on the Sabbath? Everybody remains silent. So he embraces the man, the Greek says, throws his arms around him, heals him, and sends him on his way, and everybody is aghast. What Jesus is virtually saying here is, you who sit around this table so smugly, so arrogantly, so sure that you're going to be invited to this banquet that you're talking about in this rule of a Messiah, you're rejecting the invitation and you don't even realize it. The Messiah is in front of you and you don't even realize it. Matter of fact, this man that you so smugly judged as being morally inferior to you, and me whom you're judging as reaching out to him and having compassion on him, this guy has just had the first bite of the feast because the banquet was right in front of them. This is the story truth. To understand it more fully, we have to back up and look at some of the history. The history of the Jewish people themselves. They had begun in their narrative, in their story, they told the story of Father Abraham. In Genesis 22:18, according to the Genesis narrative, the promise had been made to Abraham, in your seed, what does it say there in the grace section? How many? In your seed, all the, what does it say? Nations of the earth shall be what? According to the story, their original purpose was to humbly serve, humbly bless the other nations. Instead, I'm submitting to you that the story we have today indicates that the Israelites, they began to see their chosenness not as a vocation, but as a status. Let me put both of those words on the board this evening. The first one is vocation. Say that word with me. Vocation. And the second one is status. That's right. They began to see their chosenness not as a vocation, but as a status. The fact that they were chosen by God, literally to be the servants of all the other nations, according to the story. But they began to see the fact that they were chosen by God meant that they must be morally superior to all the other nations. They began to look down on all the other nations. They began to believe that they were more blessed than the other nations, that they were more favored than the other nations. They began to believe that they were more saved than the other nations, that they were more holy than the other nations, that they were more righteous than the other nations. Does that ring any similarity bells to anyone else in the room this evening? Do we have another religious group that seems to feel that way as well? Just a question. So God endeavors to meet these people, I believe, where they're at. The next point that I want to draw your attention to in the chronology of their story is a passage in Leviticus 18, 7 and verse 23. In Leviticus, Moses gives them this law. It says, do not dishonor your father by having sexual relations with your mother. She is your mother. Do not have relations with her. Do not have sexual relations with an animal and defile yourself with it. A woman must not present herself to an animal to have sexual relations with it. That is a perversion. I bet you didn't know we were going to be talking about that passage this evening when you thought you were going to come here. Here's my question. What kind of people need that to be a rule? Think about it for a moment. What kind of people need to be told, don't sleep with your mom and don't sleep with your livestock? Today there's a lot of talk within the Christian religion about no longer being under a law. And yet I don't find anybody saying, well, where's my dog? What kind of people need this to be a rule? How many would agree that this at least indicates that the Israelites at this stage of their history may not be as healthy ethically as we assume they are sometime in the way we polish that history? How many would agree they must have been messed up if this needed to be a rule? Now, think about it this way. If you're going to go to, let's say I'm going to go to a third world country, a developing country, and let's say they've never seen a white male. Let's say they are cannibals. Let's say they are they worship their dead ancestors, and they worship, and once a year they offer a live infant sacrifice to those dead ancestors. How many here would have some, not even religious or moral, how many would have some ethical challenges with those practices if you were going to step into that culture? Can you just step into that culture and bulldozer over all of those ethical problems and just say, I want to change you, we're not going to do that anymore? Can you do that? Not effectively. No. If you do that, what's going to be the result? Talk to me this evening. What's going to be the result? Yeah, you're going to be breakfast. That's right. I was sharing this with a group of teenagers recently, and I said, which one of these three would you endeavor to correct first if you felt so moved to try and bring some ethical change to this group? Which one of these would you endeavor to change first? And I'll ask you, out of those three, if you were to change one, which one would you choose first to change? Infant sacrifice. That's what I thought this teenager was going to say. But she said, cannibalism. I said, you would pick your own survival over the survival of an infant? She said, well, sure. She said, if it happens annually, I've got till next year rolls around to fix that. I've got till tomorrow morning to fix the cannibalism. She said, I'd go to work on that immediately. What I think is amazing in this illustration is that when she's working on the mere fact that she chooses cannibalism as the first thing to work on for her own sake, what does that immediately make you feel about her own morality? Didn't it initially make you feel like, what, she places that of greater value than child sacrifice? Doesn't it initially feel like she thinks that cannibalism is a worse reality than infant sacrifice? How many felt that happening inside of you? What, she values that as being of a greater atrocity than that? But how many realize that's not really what's going on at all? She's not being idealistic, she's being pragmatic. How many went through that paradigm shift? You see, I'm submitting to you this evening that when we come to the Hebrew Scriptures, what we see is a God that was trying to meet a people that needed to be told not to sleep with their livestock and their mothers. And he's trying to use them to take them in, to bring change to them, to help them grow and to become more ethically advanced, you could say. And he has to do it very slowly. He has to meet them where they're at. If I were in the position of this young girl and I was trying to solve the cannibalism problem, some of you might back here in the States say, well, doesn't Herb care about child sacrifice? Well, sure he does. But he's got to pick one issue at a time and patiently work with them until he can bring about the changes that he desires to make. If that makes sense to you this evening, say yes. What we find in the Hebrew narrative is a God who commands or participates at least with polygamy. How many would, and I know that everything is becoming more and more relative these days, but how many would agree that polygamy is probably not a good idea for a stable society within humanity? How many would agree with that? What I find interesting, it's always the men who want more than one wife. It's never the women who want more than one husband. I used to pick on the fact that within Israel, men could have more than one wife, but women couldn't have more than one husband. It seemed like a double standard. How many would agree? It at least seems like a double standard. And a dear sister came up to me afterwards and said, "Well, Herb, it's not a prejudice against them. They didn't need to allow it for women. No woman in their right mind would want more than one husband." So that, I understand that. The patriarchal nature of the Hebrew narrative, the Hebrew scriptures, this was a deeply patriarchal structure. This is a structure where for a woman, forgive me, at this time, was treated very little better than property. For a woman to survive in that culture, she needed to either be connected to a male as her father or connected to a male as her husband. Now, what happens if you have a patriarchal society that's also very violent? In other words, they're warmongering. They love violence. They go to war. They lose. And now you have, in a patriarchal society, more women than you have men. You just told me that you don't think polygamy is a way to promote stable society. But think of it this way, even though you think it's an evil, so to speak, societally, how many would agree it's a lesser of two evils if you're going to force women into prostitution, slavery, and begging just to have a living? How many would lighten the definition of marriage in those situations to prevent women from being forced out on the street? How many would temporarily, let me see a raise of hands, how many of you would temporarily allow men in that culture to have more than one wife for the sake of keeping women from what could come their way if they're cut off from it? Now, remember I said temporarily. Whether you would or not, here's the context. God's meeting a people where they are and choosing the lesser of two evils many times. You look at slavery. How many realize slavery is wrong? How many would agree with that? Yeah, we won't be morally relative on that one. We'll say there's something wrong with that. Ethically, morally, there's something wrong with treating human beings like property. And yet, does God participate in the narrative with slavery in the Hebrew Scriptures? Yeah, how do we make sense out of that? Nationalism and tribalism. Does God participate with that in the Hebrew Scriptures? Yeah, right now I'm stacking the deck against me. What about the violence of the Hebrew Scriptures? How many have struggled with the genocide and some of the violence of those Old Testament stories? How many have struggled with those? Yeah. What are we to make of this? I find it interesting that when Jesus shows up, according to the Jesus narrative, you have stories like this. Mary, Jesus is invited over to the home of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And according to the story, Martha is the domestic one in the family. Mary, where do we, those of you who know this Jesus story, where do we find Mary in this story? Where is she seated? Does anyone know? At the feet of Jesus. Now, what we don't know, some of us don't know, is that culturally that spoke volumes. You see, anyone could be in the room listening to the rabbi, but to sit at the feet of a rabbi, that was a place that was reserved for one group only. And that group was other aspiring rabbis. Now, culturally, rabbis were a men's only group. So this would have been a place where only young males would have been allowed to sit, and it would have only been the young males who were aspiring to become a rabbi one day themselves. And so when Martha comes out of the kitchen, upset at her sister Mary, it is much more than just the fact that Mary has left to Martha the domestic duties of that day's lunch. What she's saying is, Mary has not only abandoned, look where she's seated. She is crossing so many cultural lines. Jesus, what she's saying is, Jesus, put my sister back in her place. And what does Jesus say in the story? Leave her alone. She's chosen the best part. Now, how many women in the room find that encouraging? Be honest. You find hope in that. Yes. But did that contradict the patriarchal structure of the Old Testament narrative? Was there a contradiction there? You see, what I'm trying to describe to you this evening, when we look at some of these stories, is that there is a reality where we find, if we look at them through the lens of the Jesus story, it's not enough just to be biblical as some within the Christian religion strive so earnestly to be. You can be biblical and still be very unlike the Jesus of the Jesus story. How many would agree with that statement? My ancestors were Bible-believing, Bible-thumping, the roots of the Bible Belt. They had a ticket to heaven, so to speak. And yet they used Bible verse after Bible verse to justify enslaving millions of African-American slaves. And they used the Bible to do it. How do you reconcile that? Once again, would Jesus ever permit a human being to be treated as property? Did Jesus, in the Jesus story, did he treat human beings as valuable? Yeah, yeah. So what are we to make out of this? My point is simply this. I think what we see in the story, and this is going to have to challenge even some Christians today, is that there are some things even within the biblical narratives that Jesus comes and contradicts. It's not enough just to follow anything you find in the Bible. You can do great societal harm and even ethical harm if you just endeavor to follow the Bible. You must not just follow the Bible, so to speak. You must be listening to the Jesus story itself. If you hold the Bible in high regard, I would submit this to you. Hold the Jesus story in even higher regard and allow it to challenge what you think about the Bible itself. What we find is a God who, theoretically, is working with people where they're at and accommodating and making concessions to where people are at. We find a God who is desperately wanting this people to follow him, and so he must not only concede to where they're at, he must at some point live up to their expectations of what a deity is to begin with. They already struggled to follow him rather than Baal or some of the other gods, according to the story. So he has to meet their expectations. He has to meet them where they're at. He has to pick many times. What God wants is not always ideal. What God, in the story, what you begin to get the picture of is a God who contradicts even himself at times. I mean, Isaiah and Moses contradict each other all over the place. But what you have is many times in the older passages, you have God meeting people in a more accommodating way where he has he's looking at a horrible situation. It's a situation that is anything but ideal. And this is what he wants given a non-ideal situation. Is it what he would want if the situation were perfect? No, not at all. But the point is this. If you want to see what the Jesus story is saying about this God, strip away all the concessions and all the accommodations and you get a God that looks like Jesus Christ. What does that mean? That's the point of the parable this evening. What was happening in Jesus's day, in the Jesus story? You have a man showing up, giving a radically different picture of God than what they were expecting. If you agree with that part of the story, say yes. Why was it so radically different? Because their God was formed in their belief system after their own narratives, their own stories, that were rooted in God making accommodations and concessions. If you can see that with violence and polygamy and slavery, say yes. God, that was a softer yes. What happens when God shows up and he doesn't meet those expectations? He's completely outside of the box. Jesus shows up as the Messiah and he is completely outside of the box of what they would expect. He is completely different than what, in other words, what's going to happen when the Messiah shows up if they don't understand the difference between what is an accommodation in the Scriptures and what is what God's ideal will is in the Scriptures? If they don't make that a distinction, what's going to happen when they're so invested in the accommodations? What's going to happen when the ideal does show up and it doesn't look like those accommodations? What's the potential that could happen in that scenario? What will those who are invested in the accommodations and concessions, what will they do? Talk to me. What's the fear? What could they do? They could get angry. He's a heretic. Did they accuse Jesus of that in the story? Yeah.
He's not a Messiah from God. Did they accuse him of doing that in the Jesus story? They would say things like, he can't be from God. He doesn't even keep the Sabbath. Did they do that in at least John's version of the Jesus story? Yeah. Could they get so irate that they would even submit that this guy has to be done away with? This guy has got to be taken out, or else, as John states that Caiaphas said within the story, it is better for one man to die than virtually the way we've always done things to come to an end. Do you see what's happening in the Jesus story so far? What I'm going to share with you this weekend are the ethical teachings of Jesus. I will be completely honest with you. There are times when the ethics of what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount contradict other parts of the Scriptures, especially the book of Leviticus, especially some of the passages in Deuteronomy. How many realize how there could be a contradiction now that we've discussed this? Some background as to how that could happen. You see, today I'm convinced that Christianity is not much different. You bump into Jesus or the Jesus story, and what you find is a Messiah that doesn't believe in the nationalism of the Old Testament. He believes in a kingdom that he's come to establish that will be for all people, not just one nation. We look at the patriarchy of the Old Testament, and you find the story of a Messiah that shows up giving equal treatment and sometimes even favor for women above men. You find, and this one's the most challenging to me, and I think the most relevant to us today, you find the story of a Hebrew Messiah who rejects the violence of the Old Testament and begins teaching a radical new way to heal the world. That is through enemy love, enemy embracing, enemy forgiveness, and nonviolence. I think Gandhi said it best. Gandhi said, everybody knows that Jesus taught nonviolence except for the Christians. It will contradict even some of the things that I believe evangelical Christianity is teaching today. My plea for you is that you remain open-minded to take a look at what the ethics of the Jesus story really are, and that you'll ask yourself whether or not there is relevance, if they could hold potential for restoration, for healing, for humanity in our era as well. You see, when you look at the Jesus story, it's some of the odd things to me are, is you never see Jesus going around trying to get people to say a special prayer so they can go to heaven when they die. How many find that odd, that that's strangely missing from the Jesus story? It's just not there. Matter of fact, you don't ever find Jesus really warning people of a post-mortem hell. I can make a pretty strong argument that even Jesus' Gehenna statements were not about some post-mortem reality, some eternally burning hell that people go to when they die. I can make a pretty strong argument that he's referring to what would take place with Israel in AD 70. If you look at how that language was used in the Old Testament, those were always things that were coming upon Israel. He borrows language from Jeremiah of atrocities that were going to come on Israel in this lifetime, not some post-mortem experience, which is an interesting study in and of itself. I say all that to say this. Jesus was not as concerned with post-mortem realities as Christianity is today. Christianity today is fixated on that. Matter of fact, Christianity today, there's very little change in the here and now of most. And I know there's exceptions, but to a large degree, there's very little change in the lives of most Christians. So you tell somebody you're going to become a Christian, and they'll say, oh, that's nice, because for most people, that means you'll start going to church once a week now, and you'll have some post-mortem hope. So either you'll have a ticket to some post-mortem bliss, or you'll have some type of fire insurance when it's all said and done. One of the two, but there's very little change. I don't know about you, but if I were to tell most of my friends that I was going to become a vegan, if you were to tell some of your friends you were going to become a vegan, what would they say? Yeah, what's wrong with you? Why would they do that? They would say things like, well, you're going to have to give up this, you're going to have to give up this, you're going to have to give up, you can't eat this, you can't eat that. Why would you become a vegan? I'm submitting to you that in most circles, maybe not academic circles, but in most circles within America today, to state that you've become a Christian is not that big of a deal. because we've embraced a conventional, domesticated form of the Jesus story, where not much changes. We've settled for a version of the Jesus story where becoming a vegan is more life-changing than following the ethical teachings of Jesus. And I think that's a crime when you look at the original Jesus movement of the first century. It radically changed their lives, radically changed their societies. But that's a whole different topic. The point is that Jesus was not so focused on getting people to heaven, this is the million-dollar statement, as he was in changing the world around him there and then. He wasn't focused on some post-mortem reality. He was focused on the here and now. The story truth of the book of Acts, the early Jesus movement itself, true or false, historically accurate or not, the story truth, in their evangelism, as they would call it in our culture today, let's talk about evangelism today for a moment. What is the key thing that Christians use today in evangelism to get people to make decisions? What's the great, manipulative key that they use to get people to make a decision? What is it? Does anyone know? Fear of hell, that's right. You don't know what's going to happen tonight on your way home. You could die. And your next moment will be, have you accepted Jesus as your Savior? How many have ever heard that approach before? Right or wrong, what I find interesting is that that approach is never used in the book of Acts. How many times is hell even mentioned in the book of Acts? Does anyone know? Insert the sound of crickets. The disciples never use it. What the disciples in the story, historically true or not, we're not debating that, within the story, how does the story read? The story reads of a group of people who were selling the hope of a changed world if they would embrace these ethics that were taught by this Jewish carpenter. They were trying to change the world in the here and in the now. We have to allow the difference between that story and what Jesus is associated with today. We have to allow that contradiction to confront us. Today, Christianity, to a large degree, those who bear the name of Jesus, they are known largely as those who claim to really know God. They claim to stand for truth and righteousness. How many have heard that kind of rhetoric in our political environment? They're the ones that claim they're going to fix society. They're going to take America back for God. And I don't understand that. I don't understand that rhetoric at all. What do you mean, take America back for God? When was America ever Christian? I mean, Christian means someone who looks like Jesus, someone who endeavors to follow the teachings of Jesus. When did America ever look like the Jesus of the Jesus story? Was it when they were taking land from the Native Americans? Is that when they looked like the Jesus of the Jesus story? How about enslaving millions of African American slaves? Was that when they looked like the Jesus of the Jesus story? What do you mean take it back for God? I've looked for the golden years when they looked, when America practiced, and I know the Sermon on the Mount makes for lousy foreign policy. How many would agree? But the point is, there's never been a time when America followed the Sermon on the Mount in any of its policies, domestic or foreign. We've never done that. But we're going to take America back. They're known for those who are the defenders of truth and justice. They're going to put prayer back in public schools. They're going to fight right alongside America and rid the world of evildoers. They're going to kill them in Jesus' name, Falwell said. But the facts are this. When the studies are in, Christians today, statistically speaking alone, they are just as prone to greed as non-Christians. How many can at least see? There are exceptions, but statistically, they're just as prone to greed as non-Christians. They're just as prone to gluttony as non-Christians. What's scary, now I'm just speaking statistically, when you take polls, statistically, Christians are actually more violent than non-Christians. That's something to consider. Christians today are more prone to arrogance, or the religious label for that is self-righteousness, than non-Christians. And today, those who claim to be saving marriage have a higher state of divorce statistically than non-Christians. The rest of the world is looking at this, associated with the Jesus story, and hearing all this fix-it terminology, we're going to save marriage, not from our divorce rate, but from those gays and lesbians. They're hearing all of this rhetoric, and they're saying, you have got to be kidding me. What I'm submitting, both Christian and non-Christian alike this weekend, is that we take a hard look at what the ethical teachings are within the Jesus story that we do have and see if those ethics give us hope. The first century Jesus movement was not about getting to heaven. It was not about escaping some post-mortem hell. They believed life on this planet already was hell enough. They were endeavoring to bring about the healing of this world through following a new way to do life on planet Earth. That's what I'm asking you to consider this weekend. Again, as you can tell from what I've said so far, I'm not going to be inviting you to embrace Americanized, Westernized, evangelical Christianity. How many can at least give a sigh of relief to that? We're not going to be endeavoring to get you to make a decision in favor of that. All I'm going to be asking you to do is, whether it's historically reliable or not, we don't care yet. What are the ethics of the person in this story? And do they have any relevance to life on planet Earth today? Thank you so much for coming so far. We're going to break for about 15 minutes. We'll break for 15 minutes, and then we'll come back for the second presentation, Why I Think This is True. Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you in 15 minutes.